Hi, I'm Corey Rabin. Welcome to Crosstalk Podcast, where we inspire recovery from addiction and discover a better way. Whether you're considering a life free from substances or you're already on that path, Crosstalk is here for you. Each episode, we do a deep dive into the experiences and stories of people who have walked the walk of recovery alongside experts in the field to enhance our understanding of addiction and recovery. And that's exactly what we're going to do today. Our mission is simple: to help you navigate the challenges and celebrate the victories of your personal journey to a better life. So buckle up and let's hit the road together as we embark on this transformative journey together. This is Crosstalk Podcasts, and welcome. And today we have a terrific guest. Before I introduce our guest, I want to remind you to follow us, subscribe, hit that bell, and give us your comments. Tell us what you like. Tell us what you don't like. We want to do more of the things that you want to listen to, and so that's how we find out about it. And today we have a terrific guest, an expert in the field of addiction recovery, not just in substance use disorder, but in all different areas, and you'll find out more about that. And also somebody with whom I've worked personally and know very well, and I consider a really dear friend of mine. I'm really excited to welcome Bowtie, also known as Eric Weber. Eric, welcome to Crosstalk.
I am thrilled to be here. Thank you, Corey.
I want to just mention that Sergio's here with us. Let's start a little bit with what you do for a living, because we talked at the intro about experts in the field of addiction recovery, and you are one of the premier folks that people look to for guidance in the area of substance use disorder and in the recovery world. And so I talk a little bit about what you do now, what your background is, what your education is, just so our guests, our listeners know what you are all about.
Thanks. You know, the short version is I'm an addictions counselor. That sort of compresses everything down. I didn't start in addictions. I went to school, undergrad for psychology at Kutztown State University. Spent about 5 years there, finally getting through. Came about 2 weeks before graduation, realized I wasn't ready to grow up or adult or anything close to that. Immediately enrolled into graduate school because I figured I could just defer life for a couple of more years. Got into a master's program. And shortly after that, wound up getting diagnosed with diabetes, which sort of kick-started me into need to go get a job, get insurance, stop just being an academic dilettante, and, you know, go adult a bit. And so I started out my career in 1999, which means I'm in this 25 years. 1999, I started in mental health, started working a partial hospitalization program with folks who were suffering from schizophrenia, bipolar with psychosis, various personality disorders, folks coming right out of the state hospital, and were in day programming. So it was nothing like I had read in the textbooks. It was nothing like they were teaching me academically at school. Here's folks, and we're sort of the cutting edge of a medication called Clozaril back then, which was really helping with folks with schizophrenia. And it was quite eye-opening. Great education, just absolutely zero money. So I had to find something to actually start paying my bills. And so I found a job at the county prison as a correctional counselor. Most folks are like, oh my God, wasn't it scary? I'm 20-some years old. It was fun. Like, it's just no other way to put it. It was exciting. A buddy of mine who had worked there as an officer, who is now a state police guy, a police trooper, he says, don't worry, you'll get used to clang eventually as you're passing through the sally ports in the jail. And he was right. It became just sort of normal, which was sort of terrifying in itself. People say, did you ever feel like you were in danger? I tell people it's actually one of the safest jobs I've ever had. And I was a counselor, so it was more about relating to the inmates. The officers were the enemy. I wasn't the enemy. I was somebody who might be able to help them. So it set up a different dynamic with the people I was working with. You know, people, I remember when I was leaving, the deputy warden asked me, what did I learn being there? I was there for 4 years. And I said, I realized that people from all walks of life go to jail. It's just not like this segment. And I had a guy on my unit one time, he had passed bad checks. Walk by his cell, he's reading Golf Digest. Most of the inmates are reading like Maxim magazine or Playboy. He's reading Golf Digest. I'm like, really? He was a white collar criminal. who enjoyed golf, actually saw him near where I lived because I lived near a golf course at the time. And I'm like, okay, this is kind of bizarre. And he's walking by with his collar popped up like he's all preppy and cool. I'm like, dude, you were in PCB scrubs. You were in prison scrubs 6 months ago. Don't walk by me like you're cool. But it was interesting. If I was driving downtown Reading, taking my mom to church, somebody next to me honked the horn. Yo, counselor, what's up? And my mom's like, should I ask? I'm like, no, don't. But it was exciting.
So did you like this, your first experience working as a counselor? Did you like it?
I did. There was parts of it I really liked. There's parts of it I didn't like. What I didn't like, it was very behavioral modification based. I really wasn't doing therapy. The recidivism rate was 85 or 88% recidivism. Like, you just saw the same people coming back through again and again.
Was a lot of it drug related?
The vast majority was drug related. Vast majority. Even the more violent stuff that I would see, and I've had, you know, some significant violent criminals that I would counsel. I stopped watching crime shows, any kind of court drama, didn't want to watch Law and Order because you can't fix this in an hour. Like, this stuff just took forever. Mm-hmm. And it's more complex than what they made it out on television. The other thing that was kind of interesting, at the time I was dating somebody and we were sitting watching TV, and there was a hostage situation on the television. And she goes, ow, you're hurting me. And I realized I was squeezing her hand incredibly hard because that was like the worst case scenario, was a hostage situation in the prison. I mean, that's it doesn't get much worse than that.
So there was an underlying stress that you might not even have realized you were going through.
Absolutely. When you walk in, it's sort of like you put on this armor and you wind yourself up and you carry a certain amount of tension and awareness for 8 hours. And I had a half an hour drive home, and I needed that half hour drive to start to unwind some of that stuff, even if I could. I mean, I'd walk into the bathroom at the movie theater, and I'd pick out the best stall to defend myself. I mean, you just start thinking in these terms. It was kind of bizarre. Now, part of it is also, you know, I'm in late 20s, doing martial arts, working at the jail. You know, it's just the way my brain thought, but it was pervasive. What I consider a funny story, I don't know if she would consider it funny at this point, but a funny story. My girlfriend says, well, you know, I want to make dinner, just come over. I said, no, I want to go home first, decompress. Well, just come over right from work. Mistake. So I go over right home. I go over to her place right from work. I'm still kind of in jail mode. And her kid, she had a teenager, and he was acting like a knucklehead doing something. I don't know, whatever teenagers do. And I bark an order. I mean, I bark an order. She looks at me. She goes, excuse me, we're not in the jail. I said, you're goddamn right, we're not in the jail. Because if I did, I have some fucking cooperation right now. That was not the right thing to say right before dinner. Let me just put that out there. Yeah. Not a good move. A lot of apologies, a lot of silence, but it was
a learning moment.
Yes, and I'm just not that smart, so it took me a while to learn that. But yeah, if I didn't take that time to decompress, it did pervade into how I saw the world. Even with decompression, if I'm walking down the street, how do I see the world? How do I see humanity? When I see somebody in jail, do I have an instant response to them?
How long did you do that?
For about 4 years.
4 years?
Yeah.
And from there, you jumped to a different...
So I went to an outpatient mental health clinic. They offered me a bunch of money, which really didn't come through, but again, a good learning experience. And after about 2 years of that, just kind of got burned out. Said, I'm kind of... Let me just find something else to do. So I took what I call a regular desk job. I worked for the Easter Seals for a year. On the second day, I realized it wasn't for me, and I hated it. And then quit, just quit. It was October of 06. And I said, I'll take a couple of weeks, just relax, I'll get a job. Turned it into a month, turned it into 2 months. My birthday was coming up at the end of November. Thanksgiving was there. I'm like, I'll take a little time. I'll take the holidays off as I'm cranking out resumes and just getting nothing and nothing. Which is the point at which I applied to Karen. I was applying to the federal government down in D.C. for some government jobs. Did not pan out. Wound up coming to Karen Treatment Center in April of 07. I talked to people. I said, it took 6 months to be a man of leisure. I was unemployed. That's the reality of it. And I was pretty desperate to get a job at that point. It's interesting, you know, talk about a God moment. Every door had closed, and Karen was the only opportunity available to me for the exact price I needed to make my monthly budget. Down to the dollar.
And for anybody listening who has watched Crosstalk podcasts, they know that Karen is Karen Treatment Center because so many of our guests have gone through the doors of Karen. And Karen Treatment Center is in Wernersville, Pennsylvania. That's the main campus. Mm-hmm. And Karen has offices in four or five other states, locations. And the main one is called Magic Mountain.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And you're on Magic Mountain.
I'm on Magic Mountain. It's a big hill. I don't know how much of a mountain it is. It's a big hill, South Mountain, Pennsylvania. And I'm from that area originally, so I had known about Karen. I had a friend who had worked there, and it seemed like a decent opportunity. Funny thing is, I really wasn't interested in being a substance abuse counselor at the time. I had always kind of steered a little bit away from it. I always wanted to do mental health. I had done correctional work. I had worked with sex offenders, victims of sexual abuse, really interesting stuff. I'm like, why do I want to go do substance abuse? I'm like, eh. But I needed a job. And so I show up and I'm like, okay, let me just do like 6-9 months of this, build my bank account, see what I want to do. I get to Karen and I'm not doing cartwheels coming to the front door. But I sit down in a group for the first time, and I hadn't been a therapist for a year and a half, and like sit in a group, bunch of guys, and the hairs on my arm start standing up, and I'm like, this ain't funny. Like, I really miss this. Like, I got really excited. And just started to fall in love with it. And at my 6-month review, the executive director comes in and says, hey Eric, we want to do your 6-month review. I said, look, let me just tell you, I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. I didn't think I was going to like it. She goes, you're not quitting, are you? I said, no. I'm not quitting. I'm staying. I just want to express my gratitude. So that was in 07. And from 07, I've been an addictions counselor. I've been a lead counselor. I've been a supervisor. I've been a director. I've had a multitude of other titles, depending on what I do in that opportunity. In that time, opportunities have come about to get trained in sex addiction, gambling addiction, workaholism, an opportunity to work with a gentleman named Link Kristen, God rest his soul, who really helped me understand working with attorneys and the nuances of working with the legal profession.
What I wanted to ask is, what kind of things have you, what like themes have you seen in your nearly 18 years of working with people with substance use disorder and other disorders? Is there a general characteristics you can tell us about people who are go to treatment and need recovery? What is the typical profile being? And I know it's hard to give a typical profile because you have men, you have women, you have older people, you have younger people, professionals, you have lay people. But general arc of the personality of the people that you see who are in need of treatment, what does it look like? And the reason I'm asking the question is we may have listeners who are contemplating a life free of substances, and I want them to see if they recognize themselves in the description of the person.
No, I appreciate that. Sitting here thinking of it, in simplest terms, if I distilled it down, the person who's willing to come to treatment is experiencing pain. Either internal pain or external pain. They're either hurting from the inside or they got somebody from the outside pushing them enough that it hurts and they'll come in. But when it comes down to it, somebody's got to be sick and tired of being sick and tired and willing to make a change or at least take a look at it, right? And it might be that their family are the ones who are really sick and tired of being sick and tired and they push. But if I have to distill it down, I'd say it's pain. That's like the one thing that has not changed. That doesn't change. People coming to treatment aren't where they want to be. You know?
And so when they come to Karen, when they come to treatment, what are the first kind of things that you can do for them to make them feel like they're in the right place? And what does it feel like when you're walking in the door?
I mean, I think the first thing is to make it feel normal. To destigmatize, this is not, you're not the only one. You're not the first one. You're not going to be the last one. And that's not to diminish anybody's experience, but rather to say, look, you're not all alone. You might be scared. You might be sad. You might be completely inebriated, you know, whatever. But coming in and saying, look, you're okay. We can help you with this. You know, you're not a defect. You're a sick person trying to get well, not a bad person trying to be good, right? And just really communicating that clearly. For quite frankly, one of the hardest things is walking into treatment. The next hardest thing is walking into treatment again for somebody who's been there once, twice, and they have the shame a compounded shame. And the first thing I do to that person is give them a hug. Hey, I'm glad to see you alive. It's the first thing I say to every relapse patient I've ever treated. Glad to see you're alive, right? I know you don't want to see me, but I'm glad we get a chance to see each other because the alternative isn't great, right? So part of this is just making somebody feel okay that they're walking into treatment the first time or the multiple time. And that's not always easy.
How important do you think the recovery community is in the treatment environment? That is, there are people that say, you know what, I don't want to go to a inpatient treatment. I want to go to a therapist or I want to go to outpatient treatment. How important is it for somebody that's contemplating treatment to actually get away from where they are and be in a recovery treatment facility?
Well, I would say if somebody's not able to make changes in their environment, you need to create an environment where change can be made. Right, and that's the thing that has to be considered. I think the one thing that people don't realize when they come to treatment is the power of community, is how close they will get to the other people who are in treatment with them. I hear it all the time from my patients, all the time. What's the most important part of your treatment? And they'll say, Eric, we love you, but it was the community. And I'm like, I know that. I just want you to know that, right? And the challenge on the back end of treatment is I will ask my patients, list out, write down what were the most impactful things in treatment for you, right? My job was to create the environment. Your job is to experience it and now take it home with you. If it was community, go build a community. If it was meditation, go home and meditate. If it's keeping structure, go home and write out a schedule. I don't care what it is. Prayer, meditation, structure, schedule, meetings, community, figure it out and go recreate it. That's your job. I can't do that. I can help. I can kind of guide you and, you know, put you here or there. But the fact is the person who's going to be successful is going to go home and recreate the things that were most impactful for them and continue to do that moving forward, in my opinion.
Now, when you and I worked for a while together at Karen with lawyers, I was a big book guy. Mm-hmm. I was constantly bringing books that I had read or things that I had seen because I wanted to share them. What's your favorite book that you ever read on the subject that would help somebody who's looking to move a little bit further along with their recovery?
That's a tough one. That's a tough one. You said you're a big book guy. I'm a big book guy. I'll be very quick to whip out the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. See, he got it.
That's a good answer.
Right. I think there's a couple of passages in the big books of Alcoholics Anonymous that strike me as really important for recovery and some just for living. I mean, one of my favorite passages, and I don't quote well, so I'll paraphrase, is on page 420 of the big book where it talks about take my magic magnifying mind off of the results. Just do the next right thing, leave the results up to God, and that's it, pretty much. It's much more eloquent than I'm, you know, giving it right now. But, you know, if I took a look at anybody who comes to me for counsel, whether it's for substance use or anything else, what's the next right thing to do? You willing to do it? Just do it, and universe will take care of the rest, right? And if I apply that to my life, you know, I'm coming into the city today. It was a tough drive from Pennsylvania. It took me forever to get across Midtown. All I got to do is the next right thing. I'll get there. No matter how much cursing, yelling, horn blowing, it's not going to move the idiot in front of me down 52nd or 54th as I'm trying to come across. Do the next right thing. Don't hit a pedestrian. Weave your way in there. Drive a little aggressively, assertively, right? And get to the parking garage. Do the next right thing. I'm on time, here with you, and loving it.
Worked out.
It does. It does.
To the extent that any of your family connects to your work at the Karen Treatment Center with people that are suffering from substance use disorder, is there a connection? I know there is some kind of background. Talk a little bit about that, because some of the people that watch Crosstalk are not themselves struggling, and you're not in recovery yourself,
right?
But you do have some family experience, and sure. It'd be helpful, I think, to talk a little bit about that.
Sure, happy to. You know, one of the ways I can introduce myself is, hi, I'm Eric. I'm an adult child of an alcoholic. My father drank regularly growing up. He was not your classic kind of like fall down drunk or abusive. He was very functional. So I said, he spent 30 years in banking and another 20 years in retail management. It's really almost kind of comical. My dad worked in a bank. My mom's a seamstress. I had an older brother, and we grew up in a one-story brick ranch house in suburban Pennsylvania. All we needed was the white fucking fence and we wouldn't, you know, beaver cleaver. Everything looked great from the outside. But on the inside is all the dysfunction, despite my father not being a, you know, sort of a raging drunk, but it was the don't fight, don't act out, don't be angry, don't ask questions. Very, very kind of rigid rules. My mother was very codependent, came from a codependent family. My father was raised in the 50s, so he had a lot of prejudices from being a product of the 50s. And so, you know, that's not what a drunk looks like. That's what a drunk looks like. You know, you have it good. Don't ask questions, or you should be grateful. Even if I said, this seems a little screwy, what's the deal with this? And so as when I went to Karen, right around the time I went to Karen, my mom calls me and says, hey, can I ask you a question? I'm like, yeah. She goes, what's an alcoholic? I'm like, you need to be a little more specific. I said, you know, here's some characteristics. She said, do you think your dad's an alcoholic? I said, tell me what you see. I haven't lived at home in a number of years. What are you seeing? She starts describing his behaviors. I'm like, yeah, dad's an alcoholic at this point, like behaviorally an alcoholic, not just from an attitude standpoint, which I think is kind of interesting. If you read any books on adult children of alcoholic, you take the chemicals out, you can still have all those same behaviors and those same kind of rigid rules, and it's still pretty dysfunctional. And that was my household. Look great from the outside. On the inside, it's like there's not some stuff that's just not right here. So I talked to my mom a little bit about it. I said, what do you want to do about it? She goes, I don't know. I said, okay, you live with him. If you want to do something, you let me know. Other than that, I'm just his son. I'm not his counselor. I'm not an interventionist. I had never seen my dad drunk. Never. Never seen my dad drunk. But he always came up from the basement where the garage was every single day, two beers, and maybe had a shot of brandy or whiskey after dinner. Always. But never saw him drunk growing up. Those behaviors after he retired started to pop out. The environmental constraints popped off, and all of a sudden he had the ability to drink during the day. One of the things we recognized late in his life was he was an uncontrollable shopper. He had some other behavioral difficulties as well. I won't get into great details, but it progressed the less he had to look right, look good, show up, that he had more freedoms. The addiction was able just to start to take over more and more and more.
Can I just ask you about shopaholism is not really something we ever talk about.
Right.
And I mean, I know what the other aholisms are, but what kind of behaviors would you fit into to say that about your dad?
So if we go, if we take a look at what is addiction, how is addiction best described? Go to the Narcotics Anonymous basic text, page 87, chapter 8, in the current edition. Mine's page 84. And it says, we know well the two things that make up true addiction, obsession and compulsion. Obsession, that thought that takes us back time and time again. Compulsion, after one drink, one pill, one fix, we're caught in a destructive grip greater than ourselves. Again, I'm paraphrasing. I'm not quoting. I'm paraphrasing. But if you take a look at that and apply it to any behavior where somebody says, once I start, I can't stop, and it's on my mind, and I can't get it off my mind. So somebody who's a shopaholic starts buying and buying and buying and buying, and they may get, you know, say, I'm a collector. Okay, but it's having detrimental effects in other areas of your life. He would buy my mom, like, inexpensive costume jewelry. My mom didn't wear a lot of jewelry, but he would get excited about buying this. He ran across a watch company that he liked, and he would buy a watch and buy another watch and buy another watch and buy another watch. I'm like, dude, you only have a couple of wrists. How many watches do you need? Now, it's nice to have a watch collection, but he wasn't a watch person. It was the act of buying excited him. Mm-hmm. And I don't give a shit what he was buying. The act of buying excited him. So when my father passed away in 2018, my older brother had not been around a whole lot, came in to help, and he was amazed at dad's socks, because my father had a crew sock, every color you can possibly imagine. Then he had Hanes t-shirts, you know, for underneath his shirt, every color you can possibly imagine, coordinating mock turtlenecks, regular turtlenecks. It looked like a clothing store exploded, but it was super well organized. Some of it still had tags in. I went through his coats. Some of the coats had tags, and he's had the coats for 2-3 years, never wore them. And this is not a man who made a lot of money, right? So there was an obsession there. There was a compulsion there that I wasn't aware of because I wasn't living in the house. I don't think my mom was necessarily aware of. And if she was, she wasn't going to say anything. And my brother comes in and goes, what the hell? I said, Did you know he was an alcoholic and an addict? Because this is what we're dealing with right now.
And do these things that you went through yourself, that you noticed yourself, help you understand? I mean, you work with the patients, but also with families. Mm. Does it provide you with any help, or is it just really a footnote to things that you do with people? I keyed into the word excitement about the buying stuff, and it kind of triggered thinking about gambling, mm-hmm. thinking about food, thinking about sex, thinking mm-hmm. about all the, I mean, it's all the same, really. I mean, the page 87 or 84, you know, with the older edition, it's the obsession and the compulsion.
Yeah.
Those are the two things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the question you ask is, does it help me do my job? Absolutely. Any personal experience that I can get a better viewpoint on what somebody else might be experiencing. I'll give you an example of something that was really powerful for me, and I had to be very mindful and careful of this as a clinician. The idea of countertransference, you know, what am I projecting onto you? What are you projecting onto me? When I got married, how my viewpoint on being in a marriage changed. And then 8 years later, when I got divorced, my opinion on divorce and what the struggles of divorce and how, you know, what that's actually like, it gave me a different lens to be able to counsel somebody when they came to me and said, Eric, this is what I'm struggling with, right? And so I would say the same thing with somebody who's a family member of an alcoholic or an addict, somebody who struggles with gambling, because I've got some of that in my family and some personal history with that. I was raised in a household where alcoholism, that's something out there. We're too healthy for that. And then my father had cataract surgery, and I had to pick him up. And if you know anything about cataract surgery, they pump you full of opiates and benzodiazepines because you have to be awake. Well, he's kind of loopy. I'm doing some digging into the family history, and I get my dad talking about the actual family history, not the outside version. What's the inside? Start talking about his aunts and uncles, which I had no idea he had any aunts or uncles. He says, oh, yeah, I've got like 8 aunts or uncles. I almost got in a fist fight in a bar one time on Penn Street because I backed into my uncle. I'm like, oh, how many were drinkers? Oh, at least half of them were alcoholic. Really? I'm 27, 28, 30 maybe.
Knew nothing about it.
Just finding this out, right? I knew that we had one alcoholic in our family that nobody talked about. Here, I got alcoholics falling out of the tree like acorns coming out of an oak tree. Fantastic. Explains a few things as I look around. Now it makes a little more sense. But if you grow up in a family where you don't give everybody full transparency, the full Monty, where everything's got to look good, sometimes just reality doesn't quite work. I was sitting there trying to think, how do I relate so well to these folks if we don't have alcoholism in the family? Realizing, I've been surrounded by it most of my life. It just didn't look that way. But all the nuances were there.
Now, I want to talk about gambling a little bit.
Yeah.
You've been pretty much very public in the press about your feeling about what's going on around us in terms of the increase of online gambling. I mean, anybody's phone is now a casino. Mm-hmm. What's going on? What are your current thoughts about it? And what should we be thinking about in terms of both public policy and also our own behavior?
Yeah. Okay. I'll talk specifically about gambling, though we can link the gambling, sex, and cannabis all together in some ways. You know, somebody asked me, you know, what's different now at 25 years in counseling that was from back then? And I said, the conversations we're having and the way technology's impacted people struggling with addictions, whatever that addiction is. You know, prior to 2018, you pretty much were going to go to a state that had some gambling. You're going to go to Atlantic City. You're going to go to Vegas. After 2018, when the federal government said, okay, states, you're on your own. Do what you want to do. I live in the state of Pennsylvania. We're now the number 2 state in revenue for gambling each year. We've beat out New Jersey. We've put the last nail in Atlantic City's coffin. We have 13 brick-and-mortar casinos with plans to build more. We've got off-track betting. We've got sports betting. We've got online gambling. You want to do it in Pennsylvania, you can do it. And we're making boatloads of cash as tax revenue. Or as a friend of mine said, losses, which I thought was an interesting way to take a look at it. And we're talking billions and billions of dollars, right? Last year, across the United States, I think the overall revenue was $66 billion in revenue. Like, I don't have that kind of monopoly money. Right. And that's across all gambling, all states. But still, I mean, that's a tremendous amount of money that's coming out of people's pockets.
Did you say all states?
Yeah, that's for the United States. That's a national figure.
If it's just the United States, it's not all that bad.
Right. So, and I think, you know, if you watch sports, they're talking about, you know, the betting, the over-under, the lines during the sports, you know, during football, during basketball, whatever. It's so pervasive right now. It's in your face. And it's normalized. It's okay. And it has become, I think it's the next epidemic we're going to be dealing with. What we do know is that the 1-800-GAMBLER number, the number of people who are calling into that has exponentially increased. The demographics have changed. Who is gambling has changed. I know in Pennsylvania, because I live there and I keep track of those kind of statistics, they look like me. Middle-aged, white males, educated, access to technology with disposable income. We are the ones who are actually spending the most time and most money gambling, where previously it would have been a completely different demographic. Tremendous amount of impact on elderly, that they're gambling much more. Even though in the state of Pennsylvania, the lottery benefits its older citizens, the older citizens are also handing it back because they're doing a lot of gambling. So it's this incredible impact. And with the ability to, I'm looking at Sergio's computer, you've got, you know, a casino right there. You can be playing blackjack, get out another computer, get out your phone, get out your tablet. You know, when I'm working with a gambler in treatment, a lot of times younger folks, young adults in college, they're gambling 3-4 screens at a time. They're 10 grand, 15 grand in the hole, and it happens like that. One of the things I noticed just anecdotally is when we had our first responders program, which was a specialty program for police, firefighters, you know, EMT, you know, ambulance folks, that they were highly impacted by gambling. They would go home after a very stressful shift, crack open a beer maybe, but sit there and get on the casino, and mostly a lot of slot machines, things that were more passive, more just sort of veg out and lower their cortisol levels. So it wasn't like they're playing blackjack and staying jacked up. Most of them are actually doing much more passive gambling, which is sort of like, I just want to escape from the world. And we're still seeing that is a huge, huge part of online gambling is the table games, but a lot of the slot machines, because people do just want to be able to sit there and almost scroll. You know,
I just heard something that you said, which is really interesting. There are certain types of gambling that are more passive, mm-hmm. and there are others that are more active. Mm-hmm. I guess craps and blackjack and the other games that they have. Is that the same kind of thing from a personality or chemical react? I don't know, chemically probably the same, but that the selection of drugs that somebody takes.
Yeah, I mean,
is it similar to that?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Again, anecdotally, from my experience, you know, you have people who like, put it in front of me, I'll do it, whatever.
Yeah.
But you know, somebody says, look, I like cocaine. I don't want to do a lot of heroin. I want to be screaming. I want to be gripping onto the curtains like a cat. You know, heroin addicts are like, dude, really? I'm really not interested in that. Let me just nod out, mellow out, escape from the
world.
It's
the same as the gambling thing.
Right. And so for gambling, there's two types we can categorize. Action gambling and passive gambling. Action gambling is when I've got some skin in the game insofar as skill. Blackjack, I'm choosing. Sports betting, I'm choosing based on this, this, and this. It's actually more about my identity and feeling good about myself and me. It's more of an ego boost, right? I was just doing a conference with a gentleman who says, gambling has nothing to do with money. It has to do with the excitement. It has to do with what it does for you. The passive gambling is, let me get a scratch-off ticket and just sit there. I might get a little excited, but I'm escaping, right? With the slot machines, I'm escaping. I just want to sit there, hit the button. I'm old enough to remember pulling it. Hit the button, see if I win. It's exciting, but it's also very narrow. I'm not doing it with anybody. I'm not paying attention to the world. I'm not engaging. I'm actually disengaging and just narrowly focused on, let me just escape.
Let's move to sex for a minute. Same thing?
Pornography, sex, same thing. It's so readily available on the internet, has been for a while. But again, we're seeing it more permissive. We're seeing it more acceptable. We're seeing it more mainstream. And so with all three of those activities, you're seeing folks who might have not otherwise been triggered to start something habitually, compulsively, addictively, because it's so readily available. Now they have that opportunity. I mean, what makes an addict? Genetic potential and environmental cue, right? If I have the potential to be an alcoholic, but I never take a sip of alcohol, not going to become an alcoholic. May have some other issues, but not going to become an alcoholic. If now there's alcohol in every room of this apartment and I'm walking around and I'm prone to be an alcoholic, I have that genetic potential, and it's available, or somebody hands to me and says, Eric, it's okay, it's normal, you want to do this, everybody's doing it, why don't you? And it's that culturally normal, it's going to impact people, so many more people, so much more readily, right? So that's why I said those three things are very relatable right now, because it's Midtown, I'm walking around and all I smell is weed.
That's what that is?
It's not my cologne. OD stank.
And the other thing that we talked about, the online stuff, has to do with sex addiction as well. Yeah. Some of it's passive and some of it's active. When I guess same kind of similarity when you're with somebody and you're active with somebody, as opposed to being, if you want to call it passive, it's passive when you're just hitting buttons all over the place.
Am I just watching a scene and sort of in my own mind and, doing what I'm doing, or I'm in a chat room or I've got live streaming or there's a group of us or I'm trying to engage with other people?
So you have the cannabis, sex, gambling.
Yeah.
All triggers the same thing as your dad. It's excitement.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Obsession, compulsion.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the same brain function. They're doing some testing now, or some research rather, basically putting people in an MRI machine and showing them visuals of gambling cues, and it looks like they're doing cocaine in their midbrain. Really? It has the same effect for folks who are predisposed to have an addiction, right? And so it's when we talk about addiction is addiction. If we get rid of the details of the chemical or the behavior, it's the same part of the brain lighting up, same part of the brain shutting down. And there's this dysregulation that creates the unmanageabilities we say in the literature.
The question is, if there are somebody's in their last week of treatment, they've just gotten a good education. They're now, they're free from the substances. Physically, they're feeling better. They may have gone to the gym. They're doing some better activities. They're returning to the way they used to be, so to speak. And they're going to step out of a treatment facility, and they're going to try to bring with them what they just learned. What are some of the lessons that one learns in treatment that can be implemented when you go out? I'm kind of a how-to, get away from these type of behaviors and live a happy, purposeful, balanced type of life? It's a big question. It's not like a one sentence answer, but some of the thoughts you have on that might be useful.
So let me answer it, but reframe it. So be it Karen for almost 18 years now, I spent 6 years on the relapse unit, 5 years as the director. Would always get asked the question, why do people relapse? Right? That's what you're asking me in a different way. Mm-hmm. And so it was a very simple question. And what I realized after being able to sit with patient after patient after patient, because it was a relatively small unit, I got to meet with just about every patient who came through. One of the things I realized was in some simplistic math, there's really only two reasons somebody's going to relapse. They forget they're sick, or they didn't believe they were sick to begin with, or they've got an issue that they can't cope with, and chemicals or that other behavior are really the only short-term answer. So to answer your question is the same as answering those questions. What's something somebody can do? Remember why you went to rehab in the first place, right? You didn't go there because you were on a winning streak. You went there because there was enough pain, either internal or external. Change needed to happen, right? And the fact is, if somebody is alcoholic, addict, use the term you want, it's a chronic progressive disease. It's not going to get better. It's only going to get worse. One of the most dangerous things is when somebody finishes treatment, they're feeling like $1 million, and they go home, and they're like, I feel like $1 million. I haven't felt this good in years. I probably can have just one. I can do this again. I know better. Bowtie taught me everything I need to know. I can figure this out. I'm a smart guy. I'm the smartest guy in my head, right? What I call clinically failure to fully self-diagnose. Do I have an issue? Yes. And what am I willing to do to treat the issue? That's any healthcare. That's the bottom line, right? If I don't think my blood pressure is that bad, I'm not taking my blood pressure medication. Even if my doctor says, you fool, you're going to stroke out, right? I know better. So I think that's that piece. The other piece is having the coping skills, or developing the coping skills, to deal with life on life's terms. Just because somebody comes to treatment and gets sober doesn't mean that life's going to be dandy. sometimes life actually feels worse because you're not numbing yourself out. Like, oh shit, I do have a lot of bullshit to deal with. Fuck, never dealt with that before. And I have a patient, he's got 16 years sober. Guy is a Vietnam vet, spent 1 year and one day, basically almost always in combat. Got out of Vietnam, came home, started drinking a bottle of scotch a day for 40 years. Comes to treatment. He comes to treatment, he starts feeling better and feeling worse. Because instead of drinking a bottle of scotch a day to drown the nightmares, he's now having the nightmares that have been there for 40 years that he simply hasn't experienced. He did the right thing, went to the VA, got help, got a PTSD diagnosis, got treatment for it, and continues to work on it today, 16 years later, but has not given up because he's built the coping skills and he diagnoses himself as an alcoholic who cannot drink, right? And he'll sit there and say to me, Eric, I'm going to die sober. Like, all right, just don't die now. We got another five rounds to go. We golf together. But I think about that, like, sometimes shit doesn't get better when you get sober. Sometimes shit feels worse. That's the reality, right? And there's nothing I can do about that. I can't guarantee life's going to get better. Life will become more manageable if you stay that course. You know, I think sobriety can promise you answers or at least opportunities that otherwise you wouldn't have if you're chemically enhanced or doing other shit.
I have the gift of knowing some of the things I've learned from you, and I want other people to learn the stuff I have. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, you and I have looked at these charts about cortisol levels and the impact of when you take your substance and you cross the line, so to speak. The layman's version is crossing the line. What happens to us when we do too much and then we are kind of cross the line? What's that about in terms of the scientific or the clinical, what happens?
Right. So I think in simplest terms, what we're looking at is a neurotransmitter dysregulation. So we've got the TV here. We're going to watch an episode of our favorite show and we're going to get a chuckle and I'm going to have a little dopamine spike. And we're going to have some hot chocolate. I'm going to get a little dopamine spike. And somebody's going to pull out a line of blow. Just kidding. We're going to have a big dopamine spike and it goes back down. We're going to do another line of blow, big dopamine spike. This time it doesn't go back to normal. It slips below what we'll call the set line, right? And then we struggle to get it back up with more blow, and then it drops even lower. So the subjective experience of that dopamine being spiked and then dropped below a set line is obsession and compulsion. It's that, oh shit, I got to get some more. Even if I logically know I shouldn't be doing this, it's 3 a.m., I got to get up for work, it's in 3 hours. But my brain says, no, we need to do more with this dopamine because that feels good. And there's some other chemicals in there, but that's the basic version of when we talk about what's the difference between somebody who's a recreational user versus somebody who becomes dependent. And that dependence is when you have dysregulated the dopamine levels and other chemicals as well, but that's the big one for most drugs of mood-altering chemicals. That's kind of the graph line is when that dysregulates, right? And when somebody gets into recovery, the dopamine will level back out. But if they, as soon as they're going to use a mood-altering chemical, chances are it's going to slip and start becoming dysregulated in a way that makes somebody start acting in ways they otherwise wouldn't act.
And this ties into that person that goes to treatment that you see in the relapse unit who comes back, he learned everything, now it's going to be different. Mm-hmm. The brain doesn't say it's going to be different. The brain does the same damn thing, and you kind of can't get out of your own way.
Right.
So your best thinking doesn't work.
Right. Exactly. And even what I hear that I think is difficult at times for folks is depending. I see this with the younger opiate addicts. Somebody says, look, I'm 25, 26, I'm 30, opiate addict, I get clean. But how do I start dating? Alcohol was never my thing. Anecdotally, most opiate addicts don't really care for alcohol. There's a couple out there like, yeah, woohoo. But for the most part, the vast majority of the opiate addicts I've treated really don't like the way alcohol makes them feel. They don't like hangovers. They'll put up with being dope sick, but they don't like hangovers. Whatever, right? What's interesting is so many stories I heard on the relapse unit of young folks coming back. What brought you back? One drink. I said, you're not an alcoholic. They said, that's what I thought. I said, right, let's talk this through. Goes out, let's have a drink, a beer, right? Next thing you know, it's, you know, an eight ball blow in the bathroom. Next thing you know, they're copping, you know, a couple baggies of dope. Next thing you know, they're overdosed because their body can't handle the level of dope they had been doing beforehand. and you know, they feel kind of fucked. They come to treatment like, I don't want to be an alcoholic. I don't mind being a heroin addict, but I don't want to be an alcoholic, because there's a romance with alcohol. Or nowadays, I have this argument with cannabis all the time. Look, cannabis never got me a DUI. I never got violent on cannabis. I'm not addicted to it. I don't have withdrawal symptoms. I said, give it 30 days. You'll have withdrawal symptoms. Trust me. That shit takes a while to get out of your system. But it's the argument. It's the modern argument today, right? The other one I'm running into, which I think is really interesting, which the listeners may want to ponder, is back when I started, there was like two types of NA beer, St. Pauli's and dog piss, and they both tasted the same, right? It was a St. Pauli's, whatever it was. Now, there's so many more non-alcoholic options that taste like alcohol. You know, you've got your various seltzers, which have alcohol in them, but I'm thinking there's some 0.0 beers, right? There's a couple of brands, and apparently, for the people who've tried them, they taste like the normal stuff, and there's absolutely no alcohol. Eric, can I drink this? And I'm like, the argument is that it has some alcohol in it, it's gone out, because scientifically it doesn't. What are you drinking that for? Do you really enjoy the taste of the beer? And I'm getting yes sometimes. And it's a difficult, it's a more complex conversation to be having when somebody leaves treatment. Should I drink non-alcoholic beer? And I'm very conservative. I say, look, it's a risk.
Serge, you have any questions you want to ask? Go ahead.
Okay. So you mentioned like earlier today, you know, you're in traffic and you know, you're coming across some people who are just crazy drivers, and you got to find ways to kind of ground yourself and get through it and kind of just feel balanced and okay. And so I imagine you do that in like throughout the day, probably like in different ways with different things.
And some days I'm better than others. Let's just put it out there. Some days ain't great.
For sure. For sure. So what are the steps you walk through in your own mind to get through any challenge, big or small?
I think in simplest terms, some of it's just right sizing. Like, do I really want to have a stroke over this? Like, is this really worth me getting this anxious or upset or pissed off? You know, and sometimes just yelling at another driver feels good. You know, I can sing some Metallica or I can scream and curse you out. Either way, you know, it gets a release of energy. And other things, it's like, how long am I going to hang on to this? Because it's not good, as we talked about earlier, cortisol levels. Do I really want to be walking around with this much, you know, blood pressure and cortisol? I got enough shit to be worried about. Am I really that important? Right? If I'm really pissed off about something, the first thing, because I teach this to my patients, the first thing I ask myself is, what am I afraid of? If I'm angry, what am I afraid of? Right? If I'm pissed off at somebody in traffic, what am I afraid of? Well, maybe I'm afraid of being late, inconvenienced, I'm feeling impatient. This is not the way I expect it to be, because I am the center of the universe, apparently. Right? Ask a couple of my exes, they may say that. So some of that is just keeping perspective, and what my first martial arts teacher would call humbility. He said he didn't like the word humility, because it implied the connotation that you had to be humiliated, but rather humbility is being humble, and being humble is being right sized. It's not too big, it's not too small. It's being right sized in the moment, right? And so I think if we as human beings can right size ourselves at that moment, like, is this worth, you know, I'm on Broadway, trying to turn left on 52nd. It's a clusterfuck. Guy next to me kind of pulls in, does a New York move. I'm like, F you, but that's a good move. I respect that, right? I'm trying to get into traffic. I'm here, right? Like, I'll get there eventually, but I might have to go through that process of being very unzen before I get sort of zen. And I want what I want when I want it sometimes.
And you know? So you feel... would you say like you feel like you genuinely feel better and okay when you walk through that kind of thought process, like in your own brain, physically, like just you feel,
if you had a blood pressure cuff on me, the numbers would change.
Huh?
Right. If you strap me in, took my temperature, mm-hmm. I was going to say to a lie detector, cause that's one of the things they measure body temperature. It's going to change. Right. You know, so when I get pissed off and you get pissed off, anybody gets pissed off and excited and anxious, blood pressure is going to go up. Your body temperature is going to go up. It's a fight or flight response. Right. Cortisol gets released. Adrenaline gets released. And so you can't be walking around with that a whole lot. It's just not good for you. Any doctor will tell you that. And I'm not even a doctor.
Yeah.
But I think the more we can be aware of it, the more I can be aware of it, the better I can be at helping other people get aware of it. Because in early recovery, folks are going to have, they're going to be irritable. They're going to be discontent. They're going to have moments, especially in treatment. If somebody comes in and they're a cocaine addict, I always tell my cocaine addicts this. Day 10, you're going to have a bad day. Like right around 10, 9, 10, 11, 12, you're going to have a bad day. Post-acute withdrawal kicks in. It's like the worst case of ADHD and explosive disorder. You want to kick down my door, throw a chair through my window. Just don't. Just know that's going to happen. And most of the time, they come in and they're like, I'm super aggravated right now. So do you remember that conversation? Yeah, okay, what do I do? I said, wait 24 hours. And they usually come back 24 hours like, man, you were right. I said, well, that's a biological response to not having cocaine in your system. It's a very common thing. And so, but if we can learn to be mindful about it. And everybody likes the word mindful. It's kind of the buzzword in the last number of years. But it's also not bullshit. It's also being mindful of where are we at the moment. Am I aware of what my emotional response is or my emotional being is? Am I in touch with that? Because I think as human beings, we're so much doers. Looking yeah. around, we're interacting with the world, that are we really in touch with what's going on? And you know, if we do take a vacation, do we take the time to do that maybe on vacation? A vacation maybe every morning when I wake up, have my morning Joe, and say, okay, I'm gonna meditate for 5 days. Oh, it's so woo-woo. You know, but take 5 minutes to meditate, it may make an impact on your ability to calm down when you need to calm down, right? One of the things the military teaches, at least they did at one point, because I have friends in the military, was you would sprint for a certain period of time, and then you would lay down and you would have to shoot, because they wanted you shooting with your heart rate level, your heart rate up, simulating excitement. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to sit there and get all zen and shoot versus trying to shoot when your cortisol and your adrenaline is pumping because somebody's shooting back at you, right? And I don't, and I'm not being flippant or you know, don't want to be, you know, disrespectful, but there's a difference, right? And so when we are in the midst of conflict, when we're in the midst of that upheaval, how quickly, how easily, or not easily, how efficiently can we get our physiology to calm down a bit? That's beneficial to us long term. I'd argue it's beneficial for the world as well.
Yeah, and some, it sounds like, I mean, that's like, I guess, like one of the most extreme kind of examples is, you know, someone literally shooting back and it's life or death. But I mean, I don't know what like the readings are on, or the, you know, the research, but you know, I imagine that your heart rate and your anxiety can get to the same level over like something in being in traffic or, you know, someone, something said, or going up on stage, for example. I don't know if that's accurate or not.
Perception will dictate, my perception of the situation will dictate my reaction to the situation. Right. So I've been playing guitar since I'm 15. I'm 51. I've been playing guitar a long time. I've been playing in bands for the last 15, 16 odd years. On and off stage, been playing in bands. And somebody said, man, how can you do that? I'm like, excites me. Oh, I could never sing in front of a crowd. I used to front a rock band. I get excited about it. What you experience is terror. I experience a, yeah, let's do this. You know, somebody says, you know, are you nervous going on a podcast? You kidding? You stick a plug up my butt. I could just electrify the whole room. I get excited about this. And I'm an introvert. Right? People don't believe us. I'm an introvert, but this is exciting.
Yeah. I can vouch for the fact that when we start talking, if we have a you know, a schedule, he'll be talking longer than the he can do it.
I usually get
the lights flashing. So you mentioned earlier that there are these spikes, you know, looking at charts and like kind of reading the brain. When you're doing lines of cocaine or getting these spikes of dopamine, and gradually over time, the lines will kind of dip lower and lower and lower. So when you're in your own life going through any kind of challenging or frustrating situation, and you know, you try to like reground yourself and stabilize yourself, you know, do you get like a sense, do you get a hit of dopamine from kind of calming yourself or like walking through some kind of process of just regrounding? Do you get that hit of dopamine?
When we're talking about grounding, we're probably talking about other brain chemicals like serotonin.
Okay.
So serotonin is the happy juice that says, everything's okay with the world. Dopamine is, woo, let's get it on, let's dance, let's sing, right? Dopamine is that excitement. Serotonin is much more, everything's okay with the world. We don't have to we don't have to worry.
That's interesting. I didn't know about the serotonin and dopamine. I thought the dopamine was like that serotonin, like that ease, but it's interesting.
Yeah, it's complex. And again, I'm simplifying it. There's a complex cascade of neurochemicals. The ones I'm giving you are kind of like the major players that fronting the band, but there's a lot going on behind the scenes as well. Excitement versus getting calm and reducing anxiety and really lowering that subjective angst. We're talking a lot about serotonin, but really the behaviorally it's about mindset, perception, exercising the muscle of the brain and the spirituality of the meditation. Like, do it as a practice, right? You know, if you chase me down the street, I could probably run for a little while, but I'd really like to train for it. So part of this is just training for it, right? And so training, whether it's going to 12-step meetings as part of the practice or when the shit does hit the fan, it's part of the daily routine and the practice and what goes on. Prayer, meditation, talking to somebody, getting used. I'm going to reach out to Corey on a regular basis. So when I do need Corey or Corey does need me, it doesn't feel that much more difficult. He doesn't want to hear from me. He hasn't heard from me in 6 months. But if he hears from me every other day, it's easier for me to say, hey, Corey, man, I'm having a rough day. Yeah, man, let me give you some extra time. So as we practice those things, they become more part of who we are. And that's what makes it more accessible, right? It's not that I'm going to do this thing you do. I'm going to do this thing I do all the time, whether that's recovery or other spiritual practice.
If I'm here, I mean, I have limited kind of knowledge around this. So the first thought was like, all right, well, if this is if you can train your mind to kind of behave or be efficient in these different scenarios, whether it's a training to run or, you know, just a thought process of dealing with trauma and whatnot, can you train your dopamine levels or even just like your brain or body to handle alcohol if you are an alcoholic? Can you train yourself to be able to actually have a healthy relationship with a substance?
Not my patients.
Not your patients.
Not my patients. I'm not going to say nobody can, but the patients who are coming to see me, we've passed that. That ship has sailed a long time ago. You're coming to see me, my patients, you can't unpickle a cucumber.
But by the way, every patient that comes into treatment, every alcoholic, every addict that goes into treatment, doesn't go to treatment because their goal is to never use again. Their goal is to learn how to use like other people so they don't have
that's
a problem.
That's how my brain is thinking right now. I'm like,
that might be their goal, whether they can or not.
It's they don't teach that. If you are a pickle, you can't become a cucumber again. That's what they say in 12-step meetings.
I will say this, though, and I refer to this occasionally. If you read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think it's in chapter 3. It says if you've gotten this far in the book and you still don't believe that you're an alcoholic, go try some controlled drinking. Come back, we'll be here. Again, I'm paraphrasing. But that's in the big book.
Yeah.
Right? That's in the big book that if somebody's not convinced by that point, go try it. Like, we're not here to convince you. We are here to help you if you want help. Right? And last thing I'll say on the subject, when Dick Caron opened up Chit Chat Farms in 1957, there was a sign on the front of the split rail fence. And it says, if you want to drink, that's your business. If you want to stop drinking, that's ours. And I've always loved that because I'm not in a crusade to get people to stop drinking. I'm not. It's if you want help, right?
No.
My father was the same way. I wasn't going to tell him he had to stop drinking. If he wanted help, my mom wanted me to intervene, ask. Other than that, I'm your kid. I'm going to come see you at Thanksgiving, Christmas. You get shitty, I fucking roll. Period.
I love how you set those boundaries early, like right at the beginning of the episode. You had that phone call with your mom and you set those boundaries, and that, like, how did you feel in that? Did you realize what you were doing in that moment? Did you realize how, like, just much of a healthy response that was?
Probably not. That was probably more self-defense than anything. It was I'm not going to push my way in, and if she does invite me in, how the hell am I going to do this? You know, so part of it was self-defense. I don't know that I was that smart. Probably just got lucky. But I'll take luck sometimes. Napoleon, I'll take a lucky general over a good general any day.
I could listen to you talk all day long. You're a great example of a person to look up to, who provides guidance and inspires people every day. You're a legend in the recovery community, and I just hope that you know, people for the next 50 years or more get a chance to be with you and learn from you, and that you have good health, and that you're my friend for a long time, because I love you very much.
Love you too, man. And just thank you. I got to talk about things today that I don't normally talk about. Professional boundaries. It's about them. It's never about me. It was an unusual and just a, quite frankly, delightful experience to just sort of share openly without having to worry about this, that, or the other thing. It's a blessing I don't normally get. So I really appreciate the opportunity to share, and hopefully some of this makes some sense and some of it's helpful. And, you know, if one person's affected, it's worth it.
That's great. And
you want to do like the question, kind of like what's one piece of advice you'd give to someone who's, you know, thinking about getting help, seeking help, or just even struggling with help?
It's a small investment for the rest of your life. It's a small investment for the rest of your life. You know, 30 days of your life, shit, I spent 8.5 years in college. You know, it's a small investment when you take a look at the totality and the depth of investment. If somebody can get healthier and be a better father, mother, grandmother, son, whatever, if you can improve your quality of life for you and the people around you, wouldn't they cheer you on? It's an investment. Consider it such.
And I just like to say that just to follow up on that thought, small changes sometimes make enormous impacts. And that's what this is. A 30-day thing, you know, can start you on a path. You get some information you didn't have before, get yourself away from the situation you're in. The impact could be life-changing, enormous change. So listen, to our listeners, our devoted listeners, who have created millions of people watching this thing, I'm so grateful to you. I just thank you so much for watching. Thank you for listening. And please come back. We'll see you next time on Crosstalk Podcasts.